Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another edition of Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. It's Wednesday, the 20th of May, 2020. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined as usual by my colleague Phil Bishop, who edits our online news. How are you doing there, Phil?
I'm staying alert, David. I'm staying alert.
Oh, good. You're moving with the times. That's good to see. Well, Phil, I think the best way to start is to, if I were to ask you, what news stories have caught your eye this week?
Well, it's been a couple of weeks since we last spoke, David. We had a week off last week. Yeah. I hope we weren't missed too much, but I hope we missed a little bit. Yeah. A few things I just want to run over briefly in case listeners have not managed to spot them, and they can find out more about these on our website, constructionindex.co.uk. First one, bit of business news. Costain is going to be 15% owned by a Emirati company, Al Shaffer General Contracting Company of Dubai. It's going to take, it's taking a 15%. Costain, we've mentioned before, it's got this rights issue. They need to raise £100 million from the capital markets to stock up their piggy bank so that they can afford to pay their suppliers on time and so on. And this UAE company, this Dubai company, Al Shaffer, are taking a 15%, which is a fairly substantial stake. I guess they might get a seat on the board for that amount of money as well. I'm not sure.
I imagine so.
But that's interesting because it wasn't that long ago that Costain, when it was in graver financial trouble I don't want to say it's in financial trouble at the moment, it's sorting its problems out quite nicely, but when it was in proper financial trouble some years ago, it was Malaysian investors who took it over, I seem to recall,
yeah.
Or took control.
Yeah.
Moving on, a couple of stories in the rail sector, which are also interesting. One is relating to Network Rail as part of the rail industrial sector deal where the government and the railway industry come together to see how they can exploit opportunities in the global rail business. Network Rail have kindly agreed that their suppliers can have references from them. Now, it seems kind of surprising that this is only now happening.
Yes, that surprised me as well.
You know, if you're a Balfour Beatty or even a much smaller company who supplies Network Rail with all kinds of goods and services and you want to go work for, I don't know, SNCF in France or Amtrak in the States or whoever, previously apparently Network Rail wouldn't admit that you work for them, wouldn't give you a reference, wouldn't vouch for you. I don't know if British Rail used to do this back in the day. But anyway, Network Rail are now doing this. While it's good news, it seems to be terrible news that they haven't been doing it for the past umpteen years.
Do you think it's something that's unique to Network Rail, that it's part of their corporate culture, that they don't endorse their suppliers to other potential clients?
There are a lot of big companies who won't let their suppliers use their name to promote themselves. That's not uncommon.
Seems a bit mean,
but it's barely in the national interest for a company like Network Rail, is it? Which is, of course, a state organisation now.
Exactly.
I hope Highways England doesn't act like in that way. I hope they give references where required. The other railway story I thought was worth mentioning quickly in passing: HS2. HS2 is always in the news. Another story this morning: they've got planning permission to start construction next month of the big station in West London at Old Oak Common. The one which I thought was more interesting, and you were talking about this one, David, as well, recently with me, was that the HS2 have told their tier one suppliers, the big contractors, that they're going to pay their invoices as soon as they receive them, which is highly unusual. And they've also told their contractors that they've got to pay their suppliers immediately on receipt of invoice, not wait to the end of the month or however long they normally take to pay them. And this is all about government policy of getting public sector clients to push money down through the supply chain. So it'd be interesting to see how that works out. Finally, in passing, I do want to mention, we talked about employee-owned companies. Last month it was, a few weeks ago. And there's another one, another construction contractor, McGee Group, a London-based £100 million turnover company owned by the McGee brothers, who are only in their 50s, so I don't think they're thinking of moving off completely, but they've decided to sell 100% of the shares to an employee ownership trust. All 375 employees taking ownership of the company. You can read more about that at theconstructionindex.co.uk. So that's just a recap of some of the stories that have been running on the Construction Index over the past couple of weeks. The first major thing I wanted to talk about today, David, is the House of Parliament refurbishment plans, or restoration and renewal, oh, yes. is what they call it. This is a huge project, and it's always been a little bit uncomfortable for MPs to, we like to think of them having their snouts in the trough, but most of them are fairly normal, at least start off fairly normal human beings. And the idea of them spending anywhere between £4 and £6 billion on their own workplace at a time of belt tightening is uncomfortable for them. The fact that the House of Parliament is crumbling, the whole Palace of Westminster is crumbling, it's been patently obvious for a very long time. And they started really trying to come to terms with how they can sort it out once and for all. And then austerity kicked in, and then it became too politically uncomfortable then and politically uncharged. But the fact of the matter is they're spending something in the region of £100 million a year on trying to keep the thing from falling down. They've got rats running around the kitchen. The cellars, which are where the dining rooms are and so on, are subject to flooding at the first drop of rain. The sewage from the Thames slops in. Masonry is falling off the wall. There are loose wires hanging everywhere. It's a mess, and it needs fixing. Mm. And it's a huge... We're talking about a palace with 1,100 rooms and 1.2 million square feet. It's a big complex. Essentially, it should be condemned, but it's a symbol of our, you know, cradle of democracy and mother of parliaments and all of that. And while some people may think that they should, you know, move Parliament to a big shed in Milton Keynes, and they can do the job perfectly well there, my personal view is I like the fact that our Houses of Parliament are a grand statement piece in the capital. And I think, uncomfortable as it is, I think the money does need to be spent. And they've done study after study to justify it, and they've agonised over it. And lots of MPs are still much rather they gave the £5 billion to nurses. And, of course, I get that. Who wouldn't, you know, of course. Anyway, the reason why this is in the news is that the structure, the over... chairing body and the executive body that have been set up to do this, rather like the building the London Olympics, a sponsoring body and the executive body that they had to deliver the London 2012 infrastructure and games for the Olympics. That's the sort of structure they put in place. And they've been now set up, and the sponsor body has now said that they're going to do this week, they said, a much deeper root and branch review of the refurbishment plans than they're always going to do, you know, have a look at it. But again, it's going to be much deeper than it had intended that it would be, because the report that all of this is based on is now 5 years old, therefore potentially out of date. The economy is again expected to head into a tailspin, so it becomes harder politically to justify spending the money now. But of course, the longer they leave it, the more they're going to have to spend. And the other thing is that both houses, House of Commons and the House of Lords, have been experimenting with, because of social distancing, working from home, remote working. I don't know if you read that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, was one of several members who accidentally voted the wrong way. He voted against, I think it's some sort of agricultural bill of some kind. He accidentally voted against the government because he pushed the wrong button, or he'd, you know, software problems or something. And others did too. So it's not been without problems having MPs and peers working from home, but they can do it. They showed that they can do it. And that becomes relevant because of the billions that the restoration and renewal of Parliament is set to cost, only about a third or a quarter of it or something is actual building work. This report from 5 years ago, they gave them, it's basically, apart from the do-nothing option, which is an option, apart from the do-nothing option, was keep the Lords and the Commons sitting, working, and send the builders in around them evening, weekends, and try and work around them. And then it would take, I can't remember the figure, but whatever, it's going to take 15 years or something to get it done.
Yes.
Then there was an option of move out the lords first, fix that side, because it is a geographical split. If you look at the House of Parliament from across the river, the right-hand side is all the House of Lords, and the left-hand side is all the Commons, the Chamber and offices and so on. You could decant one side, get the builders in, then decant the other side, get the builders in. But then they decided that the best way to get it all done, the actual building work would be done most cheaply and effectively and efficiently, was empty the place for, I can't remember, 3 or 5 years, but a shorter period of time, blitz the place, get it done, move them back in. And the making new facilities for the decanting of the House of Commons, which is going to go to a government building on Whitehall, and the House of Lords is going to go to the QE2 Conference Centre on opposite Westminster Abbey. There was going to be billions spent on the admin in the organisation.
So although just for temporary works, basically.
But also you know, office facilities and the actual mechanical operation of moving it.
That was already quite controversial, wasn't it? Because I know that Richmond House in Whitehall, which is where they wanted to, or they were considering sending the House of Commons, is itself a listed building. It's not a particularly old building. I think it's early 20th century, something like that.
Is that the Michael Hopkins one with the ugly towers?
That's right, yeah.
Oh, hideous building.
Oh, well, it's obviously that. Anyway, it's listed. But when they said, oh, we're going to have to remodel this, because, of course, inside it's entirely the wrong shape. And a lot of heritage specialists were up in arms about this, because it meant that they were going to have to desecrate this listed building in order to temporarily house the houses, the commons there. So there was already some umming and ahhing about that, I know. So that might strengthen the argument for working from home instead.
Yes, and I suppose the case becomes, a lot of MPs have offices in satellite buildings around. Some MPs are lucky enough to have their office or shared office space within the main building of the Palace in Westminster. Others are in places like Richmond House, I think there's an office building, the Norman Shore North, Norman Shore South, or at least one of those. And buildings between Whitehall and the House of Commons are various MPs' office buildings. Now, I dare say now, of course, we're not allowed to hot desk anymore, are we? That's out the window. But I was going to suggest that if there's a combination of hot desking space in the House of Parliament, in the Palace of Westminster, and, you know, working from home in remote voting, it would be an effective way of working, perhaps, for Parliament. And I think this is what's informing this new look at what needs to be done for the or what the way forward should now be for the restoration and renewal of the House of Parliament. Because if they can sell the satellite buildings, if they don't need the satellite buildings for MPs' office spaces, then that would fund refurbishment work that's needed in the Palace of Westminster, and therefore no cost to the taxpayer, perhaps, maybe even a tidy profit for the I don't know what a Whitehall building would go for, probably not £2 billion. But I think the suggestion is, if we are okay with MPs and peers voting remotely, whether it's from home or from the Marquis of Grandsby public house around the corner, if we're okay with them doing it during the coronavirus crisis, then we'll be okay with them doing it after the coronavirus crisis.
Well, I suppose it does set a precedent, doesn't it?
We are all supposed to be working, you know, the encouragement is to work from home, in the future, moving, and if they're moving forward, I hate moving forward. I hate the expression.
in the future. This, in a way, is a very public manifestation of an exercise which I imagine is probably going on in businesses all around the country now. People who have furloughed staff or handed out laptop computers and told people to go and work from their spare bedrooms presumably are assessing how successful that's been, how efficient it is, and possibly considering doing it on a permanent basis. And for obviously for a lot of workers, especially those who have to commute into the cities on a regular basis, there are some obvious benefits there. Saves an awful lot of time and quite a lot of money in travel.
At the very least, I think during the transition, the decant period, there will be a requirement, or there's a potential for reduced facilities during the decant period. Even if we say, no, we don't like the idea of our MPs working from home, it's too much scope for them to be lazy and can't keep an eye on them, or see them on telly where we can see them or whatever. At the very least, we might say that what's happened for the past month or two. We'll let that happen for another 3 years or whatever during the refurb period, 3 to 5 years refurb period, and then go back to the old way of working. But by then, maybe the old way of working will feel like an old way of working and won't have quite the same appeal. So,
exactly.
These things are interesting.
Moving on to a rather more somber topic now. There's been a story in the news this week, which again, interestingly enough, involves a certain amount of working from home, because it was a judgment made remotely by a judge, Judge Godsmark, sitting in Nottingham Crown Court on the 13th of May over a case involving health and safety at work. This was a case of two workers employed by a £6 million turnover construction company who were working, I think, I can't remember where they were working, but they were travelling back from somewhere in the south of England to Doncaster.
Stevenage. They were working as railway welders in Stevenage on the night shift.
And they had, a fatal road accident. The chap who was driving the van, there were two of them in the van, the chap who was driving fell asleep at the wheel, we assume, and drove straight into the back of a parked lorry on the hard shoulder. And both he and his passenger died. That was Zach Payne, a 20-year-old Zach Payne, was the driver, and his passenger was Michael Morris, age 48. This happened in June 2013.
It's taken a long time to sort it out, hasn't it? 7 years.
It has.
Wheels of justice turned slowly.
It has indeed.
For the poor families. Yeah.
And their employer, a company called Renown Consultants Limited, was found guilty earlier in the year, found guilty in March, in fact, March 2020. And Judge Godsmark finally passed sentence earlier in the month, this month. And he's fined them £750,000, certainly no slap on the wrist, for a company which I think has a...
It's more than 10. Well, the actual fine was £450,000 plus £300,000 in costs. So it works out at £750,000 in total, which is more than 10% of their turnover, which is, a very good slap on the wrist for them. I mean, it's a horrendous story all round, but it just goes to so much of what we've talked about in the respect and the way that managers and company managers treat their workers, and the respect or lack of respect they have for their workers. And fatigue is, I mean, it's Mental Health Awareness Week this week, but I think fatigue is heavily wrapped up in that. And these guys had completed a night shift and they were driving back to Doncaster in the early hours of the morning. And while I suspect a big part of the fine, or a big chunk of the judge's decision making on the level of the fine, was determined by the fact that the company's insurance policy had said that all company vehicle drivers had to be over the age of 25, and they routinely had people younger than 25 driving. For me, you shouldn't flout insurance policies, of course, it's bad and it's stupid. But to me, the graver issue, the bigger issue, the more widespread issue, is knackered construction workers, shift workers, putting in the overtime. And that is not just a management issue, because I think there are very many workers in construction and other industries who find the offer of overtime or double pay or a night shift they can't get a day shift. Workers want to work on the whole, and they will go where it takes them. And there aren't many workers who will say, even if they wanted to, who will stand up to the boss and say, actually, I don't think I should do that. I might be a bit too tired to drive home. And I suspect that if bosses said, well, we'll pay for your digs, many workers might still say, well, I'll keep the money for the digs and I'll drive home anyway. Yeah. It's only, 90 minutes away, an hour away, I'll be fine. So to a certain extent, we all need protecting from ourselves. But more than that, it's just a function of the construction industry of antisocial hours, hard physical work, antisocial hours, and then having to get home and cope with that and how we deal with that afterwards. It's routine across the industry, and this was just the most horrible example of what happens as a result of that. I mean, you and I have both written about these cases in the past of tower crane erectors who have made mistakes erecting tower cranes, for example, that have then fallen down because they've been working through the night and driving through the night to get from one end of the country to the other to do the job.
Yeah.
And eventually things will go wrong when this is the environment and the working conditions.
I think you're right. I think there is. I think it is very, very widespread, and it's the sort of thing which people do all the time. I mean, you drive down any motorway, and sooner or later you're going to see a sign saying that tiredness kills. Take a break. We all know about that. People still tired drive when they're tired, and you know, if you're miles from home and you want to get home and there's nowhere to stay in the interim, then you keep going. You might stop for a nap on the way or something like that. Fatigue is one of those things which I suppose we consider to be part of a normal part of life. We don't really see it as a hazard. It's just feeling tired. Everybody has to make a judgment. If they think they're unfit to drive, then they will take some time out. But if you're that tired, your judgment itself is impaired. So, you know, the inevitable will happen. But I think you're quite right. A lot of these jobs which require people to work a long way away from home and travel long distances to get there and do the work, people will cut corners in order to, as you point out, in order to maybe save a few pounds. And that will mean not getting a decent night's sleep and consequently having to either work or to drive when you're tired, which of course, as we've seen in this case, is potentially fatal. The fact that the company itself appears to have accepted this as a normal state of affairs, I think, is probably at the heart of this case. The judge said that, you know, there was no oversight, basically. The people were allowed to make their own decisions. There was no enforcement of the guidance not to, as you pointed out, the fact that we had Zach Payne, who was only 20, driving the van when no driver was supposed to be aged less than 25, shows you that there was no oversight, really, and this is why this was allowed to happen.
But I suspect there are many good managers who do seek to monitor and control excess hours and tiredness and so on while people are at work. And perhaps even they, once the gang get in the van and drive home, think, well, they're off the clock now, not my business. And and I think there needs to be a recognition that it's the job of managers, the duty of managers and employers, not just to get the team off-site safely, but to get them home safely.
Yeah.
And that is so relevant point at the moment with all the social distancing site operating procedures that we've talked about in the past few weeks. It's not just social distancing on site. It's getting people to and from construction sites without having them on crowded tubes and buses.
Yeah.
And on the whole, many of the employers are alive to this, aware of this and acting on this. But it bears repeating that when workers are off-site, off the clock, off work, they are maybe not your employees, but you maintain a burden of responsibility for their welfare.
Well, look, let's end on a more upbeat story. And this was a great story, which appeared, you posted on our website this week. It's almost literally a blast from the past. It's a case, a demolition firm, AR Demolition, whose boss, Richard Dolman, I think is he the president of the Federation? I can't remember. But he's well known.
He's a top man in the industry. And this is a great story. It's the pictures that make this story. It's a nice story.
Absolutely. The pictures are wonderful.
I do encourage people to go onto our website and have a look at the pictures, because they are beautiful photos.
They certainly are. This is a most unusual application of equipment. AR Demolition was doing what it does, which is demolition work, in a quarry, actually, Croft Quarry, which I believe is owned by Aggregate Industries. They were removing an old conveyor housing or something like that, a structure that's about 100 metres long, which had been cut into pieces, and they needed to winch it up a steep slope in order to get the pieces out and dispose of them. According to Richard Dolman, the cost of hiring a winch was prohibitive. I wouldn't have thought winch hire was that expensive.
Well, you've got to anchor
anyway,
it as well.
He reckoned.
I suppose if you're winching up however many tons of equipment, you know, how many tons the sections that they're pulling out weighed. You've got to anchor the winch into the ground as well. And I suppose that's an engineering
process. Yes, that's true. Well, anyway, that wasn't that he ruled that option out. He thought that we can find another way. And the way he found, I'm sure this was in the back of his mind before he even considered it, was to bring in a 102-year-old steam engine, what we would call a traction engine, I suppose. The sort of thing which you'd normally see only at a county fair or something like that. This was a beautifully restored steam engine called Avis, that's the name of it. It was owned by, I think, an employer of AR Demolition. An employee of AR Demolition.
The father of one of the employees is a steam enthusiast and had a hobby, I guess. I don't know if he bought it and done it up or bought it in good nick. But yeah.
Oh, yes, the owner's called Robert Holt,
that's right.
based in Hinckley, lives in Hinckley in Leicestershire. And his son Richard is a fabricator at AR Demolition. Yes, absolutely. So they bought in this wonderful old engine, which had in its previous life, it had done work for Courage Brewery and also Sir William McAlpine, son of Sir Robert, who established the well-known McAlpine clan. This wonderful old machine came along, and it's actually got a winch underneath the chassis. And if you look on the website, you'll see we've got video as well of it actually winching up these pieces of conveyor housing, and it does it really quickly. I was quite amazed how quickly and efficiently it did the work.
For a machine that moves slowly on the road, it makes light work of that,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was quite remarkable. Robert Holt, the owner, said that once it gets in its sweet spot, everything moves really quickly. This is a quote. Once she's warmed up properly, she gets in this sweet spot where she's a joy to work with. My dad and I, as well as Richard Dolman, AR Demolition's co-owner Andrew Thompson, are passionate about old machinery like this. I think it was wonderful to see. I mean, it's the cleanest machine on site as well. And there it is, sitting next to a great big demolition excavator, which looks almost space-age by comparison. And, you know, you start to think, well, I wonder what other pieces of old machinery could be pressed into profitable service in substitute for more modern techniques. We often talk about new ways of doing things, but here's a case where somebody's found that the old way of doing something is actually the optimum solution, which is quite remarkable, I think.
I don't know. I'd be interested to really crawl over the numbers. I mean, all power to the Holt family and to Mr. Dolman at AR Demolition. It's great, but I suspect that the publicity that he's got as a result of this has got to be, if you factor that in, it may have helped swing the cost. there might have just been an element of, you know, big boys having fun with their toys rather than it being an entirely rational decision. But I'm still delighted to see it happening.
Well, possibly, but it must be very very gratifying for Robert Holt. He's got this machine which he's lovingly restored. It's in perfect working order. But it's rather like, to make a rather inadequate comparison, when I was a little boy, I had a Mammod steam engine. Did you ever have one of those?
I didn't. I was more interested in footballs and cricket balls and things and Airfix models and steam engines.
Well, I had a stationary Mammod steam engine. And what you would do is fill up the boiler with water, fill up the burner with meths, light it, wait until it was hissing and whistling. And then you'd flick the flywheel, and this flywheel would spin round, and there'd be this smell of hot oil and steam. And you just stand there and watch it. And in a way, it was a very passive sort of thing to do with it. And I often think that with an old steam engine like this, you know, you get it out in the summer and you drive it to the local county fair and you fire it up and everybody stands around and looks at it just spinning around. But it must be very gratifying to actually be able to do a proper job of work with it so that you can actually show what it's capable of doing rather than just being a curiosity. Sorry. Hello? Hello, darling. I'm podcasting, so I'll ring you back, okay? Yeah, okay, bye. Sorry about that. Yeah, so I think that probably made a rather routine job extremely enjoyable for the team on this particular occasion. And clearly it did the job, and it was probably the best solution at the time. So I'd love to see more steam engines, and maybe we'd see some old steam rollers surfacing our roads.
Is steam the only emission coming from these machines?
Oh, no, no. That, well, I suppose that's... why do you have to mention that, Phil? You've spoiled it now. I mean, presumably they're burning coke or something equally filthy, and there's probably a lot of... or maybe oil, maybe gas, I don't know.
But, I suppose... apart from in London and other areas where they've got the special local orders... you're allowed to use dirty old machine. You're not allowed to buy new. It's the emphasis on the manufacturers. They have to make stage five for a lot of the big engines now. And even though we're not part of the EU, we still abide by EU emissions regulations. I don't know how long that's going to stay for, whether we're going to get tighter or looser on that. So if you already own a 100-year-old piece of machinery and you're not in a low emission zone area or ultra low emission zone area, presumably you can use these things.
Yeah, I suppose so. Why not? I mean, we've mentioned in the past that your average farmer uses an old tractor. I mean, I know there are very, very smart, clean, modern, powerful tractors out there, but most people are driving around on an old Massey Ferguson.
But not a 100-year-old J&H McLaren.
Yeah. Not many of those, I must admit. I mean, oh, God, maybe we'll see draft horses brought back into operation. That would be both green and historical, wouldn't it?
Well, that excellent. Let's do it.
Well, I think if any of our listeners know of companies in the industry that are using antique machinery for real jobs of work, I'd love to hear about it. I think it would be well worth us reporting.
This is where we do our Esther and Cyril. We believe this is the oldest piece of construction machinery working in the industry today, unless you know different.
Yes, indeed. You must email us, or you could send a letter, of course.
Or a pigeon.
Yeah, or a pigeon.
If you do want to email us, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. If you want to leave a review on Apple Podcasts and tell people what you think about it, if you like us, tell people. If you don't, keep quiet.
Don't.
That's all for this week from David and I think. So thank you very much for listening. Do subscribe if you haven't yet subscribed. So from all of us, goodbye for this week.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing. We're currently offering a massive 80% discount on subscriptions to the Construction Index magazine. Order yours online today for only £1 per issue. Visit theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine to subscribe. First issue, the 15th of June.